This is episode 434, dated Friday, October 17th, 2025.
You are listening to the In Perspective weekly podcast with Bob Branco and Peter O'Toole.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to In Perspective. My name is Bob Branco. Good to be with all of you this fine day. Before we continue, just let me say that this is episode 434. Dated Friday, October 17th, 2025. First, let me introduce our good friend, colleague, and co-host, Peter O'Toole. Peter, what's going on?
Hello, Bob. I am currently in Eugene, Oregon, which is about 2 hours away from Coos Bay, a little warmer here. And on Monday, I board a cruise ship in Los Angeles, and I'll be gone for a week. So I'm happy to be here, and I'll see you all in 2 weeks from today after this show's over.
Where are you going, Peter?
We're going to Mexico.
Ah, sí, señor. Okay, well, I hope you have a good time.
I hope so, too.
All right, so before we continue, let me just tell everybody how the weather is up here. We're dry now after we had a deluge of rain earlier in the week. It got a little chilly. It's still kind of chilly here in New England. It's in the 50s and 60s, but it's going to be dry and a little warmer moving forward. Before we continue, let me thank those people who make it possible for In Perspective to be made available. We start out with Raymond Gay, our producer. Thank you for what you do. Peter from Canada, that's another Peter, he posts our shows on the Friendship chat line. Thank you very much, Peter, for doing that for us. Also, the media sources, thank you for airing us. And, of course, Jacqueline Sylvia from JS Web Solutions, who archives most of our shows on my website. In order for you to find them, go to www.brancoevents.com. Arrow down until you get to In Perspective Podcast. Click on them, and you will see most of our archives from latest to earliest.
Merci, Jackie.
I want to say hello to Trish, our facilitator, and I want to thank her very much for helping us out today. Same goes for Diane, our streamer. And because we're being streamed, let me give out my email address for those people who wish to write us. We always would like to hear from our listeners. Our email address is bobbranco93@gmail.com. That's bobbranco93@gmail.com. And that's all one word. I also want to say hi to two listeners who wrote letters to us. We always acknowledge our listeners when they write to us. Barbara Spencer and Rick Triano, thank you very much for listening. Back for a third appearance on In Perspective today, we have with us author and military historian Mark Carlson. Of course, Peter also dubs him the canine ventriloquist, and I think I understand what that means. Mark told me out before the show started. I don't know if he wants to tell us now, but first of all, welcome back, Mark. It's good to have you.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you, Peter, and everyone else. I appreciate it. Peter, you've got a new guide dog in your neighborhood in Eugene, Oregon.
I do?
Yeah. Billy Spires, a local musician, just graduated from Guide Dog for the Blind with a dog named Neptune. I think it was the yellow Labrador, male yellow Labrador. Just graduated a week ago, so he lived in Eugene, Oregon.
Well, it's always nice to have another canine around. My guide dog is currently visiting friends. He's not going on the cruise with me. He doesn't warm weather, so he's going to stay.
Why not? Ship that poop decks.
Yeah, whatever. So he's staying with friends, and I'm going on the cruise dogless.
Oh, good.
So anyway, you are an author and a military historian, and you told us before we started that you are going to write about or are writing about the Titanic. And we all know the story about the Titanic, or at least I think most of us know the history of that ship and what happened back in 1912, I believe it was. I happened to see the movie back in 1998, so I know all about what happened and why it happened. It was a tragedy, say the least. But anyway, tell us what you plan to do about that.
You know. Well, I will plug my book, but I'll do it a little bit later when I think it's appropriate. It's a novel, and it will be published by the end of the year. It will be called Phantoms in the Abyss. So it's sort of a Titanic high-tech ghost story as well. Mm-hmm. But I have a I have a quick story that I'm going to start this out with. We all know the story of the Titanic. We know that she was a British luxury liner that sailed from Southampton to New York in April of 1912, carrying 2,200 people, the rich and poor of Europe. Halfway across the Atlantic Ocean on her maiden voyage, she struck an iceberg on her starboard side and sank with a great loss of life because there weren't enough lifeboats. Now, everybody knows that story. It's common knowledge. But the year after the Titanic sank, a book started appearing in bookstores in Great Britain, France, Canada, and the United States, and it was called Futility, or The Wreck of the Titan, written by a man named Morgan Robertson. And he was telling the story of a ship called the Titan. She was, like the Titanic, she was 800 feet long, weighed 40,000 tons. And in April, she sailed on a maiden voyage from Southampton to New York, carrying 3,000 people, the rich and poor of Europe. Halfway across the Atlantic, she struck an iceberg on the starboard side and sank with a great loss of life because there weren't enough lifeboats. Now, it's pretty obvious that Morgan Robertson just took the Titanic story, created some new characters, used the same figures, the same numbers, and just took two letters off the name from Titanic Titan, and he created a bestseller. This was a bestseller all over Europe and North America. But here, as Paul Harvey used to say, it's the rest of the story. The 1913 release of Futility by Morgan Robertson was, in fact, a reprint. It was first published and distributed in 1898. 14 years before the Titanic sank. We need Twilight Zone music.
So that's a ghost story or something, right? I mean, that's...
Well, that's just one of those things that you just can't really figure it out, but it's true. It really is. I mean, this guy wrote the story long before the real Titanic was even built.
Then how come Morgan took credit for it?
Well, he wrote the novel. He wrote the novel in 1898, but he had it reprinted and released it again in 1913.
Okay, so it was re-released. Okay. All right, great. Mm-hmm. This eerie, he called it the Titan, and that was sort of like a fictitious story, and then the real ship, the Titanic, sank 14 years later.
That's right. Yeah.
So. The Titanic has been around obviously since 1912. You know, it's 125 years ago when this happened.
123,
and,
yeah.
Yeah. And the its power is, still here. I mean, people are still writing about it. Obviously you are. Obviously there are many reasons why it would be such a story, right? Lots of life lost and, the arrogance of the captain and all that stuff. Why else do you think that story is so powerful even now? You're writing about it. What prompts you to take a run at that now?
Well, I've been fascinated by Titanic since I was about 10 years old. I saw the early movies, A Night to Remember and Titanic with Barbara Stanwyck and Clifton Webb. It was just something that fascinated me. And over the years, I got to become more and more interested in the Titanic story, reading more books and watching documentaries and things. It just kind of captivated me. It's hard to pin down a solid reason why Titanic, after more than a century, almost a century and a quarter, is still enthralling people and why there are private expeditions to visit the wreck. Lusitania, Andrea Doria, Britannic, Empress of Ireland, they don't get anywhere near as much public recognition as Titanic. And the movie, the 1996 movie, only enhanced that. But Titanic marked the end of the Victorian era when there was an all-pervasive belief, especially among Britons and among a lot of Americans, that humans had finally conquered nature, that humans had built the biggest and best and the longest and the fastest and the tallest, and we had beaten nature, and nature, finally must bow to human technology and human engineering. The Titanic destroyed that. It was such a shock that the public, I mean, there are accounted stories of people when they heard about the wreck, they went out onto the streets and they found their neighbors and they hugged and cried and everything. It was such a shock. It was like 9/11.
Yeah.
It was their version of 9/11. And of course, the Great War started just 2 years later. But all these what ifs, there are so many what ifs in the Titanic saga. Any of the what ifs, we would probably have never heard of a ship and she would have just ended up being another one of those ocean liners. I mean, what if they had collected all the iceberg warnings? There were 13 of them on the 12th and the 14th, but nobody had mapped all these icebergs and they would have seen what was in front of them. What if Bruce Ismay hadn't insisted that Captain Smith light the last four boilers to make the ship go faster? What if the lookouts had seen the iceberg just a little bit sooner? What if the Californian, which was only 19 miles away, had responded to the distress rockets? What if the third class passengers had not been held back, which is one thing I am sure of, and it's in my novel as well. There's so many, what if the bulkheads, the 16 watertight compartments, had been extended all the way up to the main deck, preventing the ship from flooding completely? There was just, what if there were enough lifeboats? They only had a capacity of 1,178 people. But if they had followed what Thomas Andrews, the ship designer, had insisted on, there would have been 64 lifeboats, and she could have carried more than 3,000. Those lifeboats would have carried more than 3,000 people. Every single person could have gotten off. But none of those things happened. And it is a microcosm of the end of the Victorian era and the beginning of the Edwardian era, where we suddenly realize, well, we still have a few bugs in the system. I mean, if the biggest, most luxurious, fastest, most advanced ocean liner in the world can be sunk in 2.5 hours by a piece of ice, we're not as omnipotent as we thought.
Clearly not. Clearly not. So
we're still learning that, by the way.
Yeah, I was just thinking that. That lesson we could still use to learn, I think, a little bit. You know, I'm thinking about, you mentioned 9/11, right? There are a lot of what ifs with that too. You know, we know that there were, you know, some warnings that this might happen. There were that appear to have been ignored. You know, what if they had been taken more seriously? You know, so, you know, whenever you have stories like that, they're always, you know, what if, what if, what if.
Yeah. It's always the chain of events that lead to the final.
Yeah.
Final option. Yeah. And yeah, the FBI was not at its best prior to 9/11. So.
Well, it was, you know, the FBI, the CIA, you know, the Bush administration, as I understand it, was warned that this might happen. And at least the story that I heard chose to ignore it because it came from the prior administration. I don't know how true that is, but I did hear that
So. And I tend to believe it too.
Yeah.
It's partisan politics can do more damage than anything, as we've well seen. You know, you don't want any, as long as the other guy doesn't get any credit, you don't care how bad they are. So.
Yeah. I think that's what's going on these days in part with the shutdown. When I knew you were coming on the show, I wanted to ask you as a military historian, what your thoughts are about what's going on with the media and the Pentagon. To the best of my understanding, essentially the Pentagon has said, you cannot do any independent reporting. You can only report what we allow you to report. You know, you can't have unlimited access or less access than you used to have. How does that rub you as a military historian?
Well, it's happened before. Not a new problem. The military has to have some secrets. They can't, a military force, no matter what nation you're talking about, have to have some secrets in order to function. That's just the way it is. They can't put it on their Facebook page, we will invade Germany tomorrow morning, you know. And the media insists that the people have a right to know. I love it when reporters use that line. The people have a right to know. But the military is within its rights up to a point to protect their sources, their intention, things like that. And that's just necessary. And the media has the right to report the story, but they must also balance that with the good of the country. In the first couple months of the Second World War, Admiral Nimitz was being besieged by reporters who wanted to know what the Navy was going to do. Where are we attacking? What are we doing? And Nimitz said, listen, I can't tell you something because it'll get back to the Japanese, but I will let some reporters go along with the task force and you can see things that they're happening and you can report them, but I can't give you any prior knowledge of it because then it won't happen. So there was, he got along well with reporters and he understood what they needed and they respected that. Now I don't know if that respect still exists, but it is important for the military to have some point at which they can't provide information seriously. It's just not safe because they'll endanger. And so when you tell a reporter, listen, if you report this, you could be responsible for the lives of tens of thousands of American soldiers. You want that? Just to report the story? Is it that important to you?
Mark, wasn't there a ship named after Mr. Nimitz? I remember the USS Carrier Nimitz.
Yeah, that's a carrier.
Yeah. Is that Nimitz. Named after him?
Yeah. CVN 68. It's a USS Nimitz, one of our nuclear carriers.
So sort of keeping on that string, Mark, and I agree with you. Clearly there are secrets that the military should not disclose and the reporter should not report. The other side of that is, you know, I'm thinking about the military budget, the Department of Defense budget, or now as President Trump calls it, the Department of War budget. By the way, what do you think about that? Department of Defense, Department of War, any sort of reaction to that?
Well, ever since the Eisenhower administration, when he first brought up that old chestnut about the military-industrial complex, there's no doubt it exists. The military feeds the industry that provide their equipment. And prices are unbelievable now for all kinds of things. You know, it's extremely expensive. But I think it can be balanced by the fact that by the end of the Second World War, there were 12.5 million Americans in uniform. We had the biggest fleet in the world. We had the biggest airports in the world. We had more submarines than anybody else. We had more tanks. It's unbelievable because numbers were important then in order to achieve their goal. Now today, I'm not sure where we are ranked numerically in the Navy, the Army, the Air Force, the Marines, but it's quite a way down. But because technology now is so much more sophisticated, we don't need the numbers that we used to have in great human wave overwhelming attacks from battleships and from tank divisions and so on. We don't need that. We can use less equipment and less personnel, military personnel, to achieve the same end with a correspondingly lesser loss or risk of life. Yeah, the tank can cost several million dollars. Yes, but, you know, it's the best in the world. And the ships we have are the best they can possibly be, the same with the aircraft and so on. So we're balancing what the mission is. What would you need to have to achieve a certain goal, to reach a particular objective? You don't need nearly the kind of numbers you did 70, 80 years ago. And you can risk less people and so on. So I think we can't really get around the fact that these things are, the military budgets have to be so high, but they can make a better use of it with the specific. Now, I'm not a fan of drones, but they are the wave of the future. If you use drones to take out military targets and specific objectives, and you don't have to risk a human life at all, I think that's worth it. But it's been a hydra in history forever. It's always been that way, and we've come up and gone down and come up and gone down. But we still have the technology to do some incredible things without risking as many of our people's lives as possible. And they're well trained, they're well disciplined, they are motivated, and they have all the support they need to do the job with much less than it would have taken back in Anzio or Sicily or Iwo Jima or so on. Could be done much more surgically now.
Speaking of drones, it seems to me from what I'm hearing, and this of course may change tomorrow, is especially effective if you have fewer resources. If there, I'm thinking of Ukraine, for example.
Yeah.
They seem to be using drones in really an effective way, you know, to attack Russia. And it seems to be hard to stop.
Well, it's an old adage that a cornered mouth will bite like a tiger.
Yeah.
And the Ukraine is somewhat the underdog, but they're being clever. They're using whatever resources they have. They can't afford a big, expensive air force, you know, with highly advanced avionics and stuff like that. So they use what they can do, and they're doing great with that. They're changing the way wars are being fought. It's becoming more and more automated.
Is that what we used when we attacked the nuclear facility in Iran?
The recent attack or the one back in 1982?
Oh, the recent attack. I think it was in late June.
I believe they used the Predator, which is, it's not a drone like the little ones you are talking about. Yeah, the Predator is a big unmanned aerial vehicle that can carry Hellfire missiles and several other things. And I think that's what they did use.
I thought that there were pilots flying that plane or those planes that dropped, you know, the bomb on the Iranian nuclear sites. Is that what we're talking about?
There were live pilots, but they did use the drone for some things. You know, to be honest, I really don't remember the specific details. All I did was roll my eyes and say, oh boy, here we go again.
And by the way, we've never really know what destruction indeed happened. I mean, I've heard anything from very little impact to it's delayed the Iranian.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't even know what to think at this point about who to believe.
Yeah. It'll eventually come out. I imagine some author will dig it out, but yeah, the best way to win any war quickly and decisively is to remove the enemy's ability to fight, to remove their ability of waging war. You just take away all their tools and make it impossible for that enemy to use its own weapons. And weapons of mass destruction, chemical, nuclear, and biological, are horrifying. But, you know, we're talking politics again. The politicians are the ones that begin wars, but it is the troops that end the wars. And that has been true from the beginning, the very beginning.
So I'm curious about something. We're talking about asymmetric warfare, right? Where of the folks who have the weaker hand, as it were, find ways to be really, really effective, whether it be Ukraine, whether it be what we call terrorists in the Middle East. You know, the 9/11 folks were, terrorist attack was an example of asymmetric warfare. And I'm thinking about the American Civil War, you know, where, you know, the North finally won the war. And there's been some talk about why didn't the South, they could have continued the war in a low effort, you know, using sort of what we call terrorist means.
Guerrilla tactics.
And what's that?
Guerrilla tactics.
Guerrilla tactics. That's a better word. Thank you.
Yeah.
But yet they didn't. I know you've written about Lincoln and other people. Do you have any sense as to why they didn't?
Well,
I mean, to me, it's one of the most miracle of that war that it didn't continue after, you know, the war was won, so to speak.
First of all, the South was always at risk of being blockaded by having its port blockaded by the U.S. Navy. Second, they were an agrarian economy. They were not industrialized. They had a few cannon foundries. They had some industrial base. They had lots of railroads, but nothing like compared to the Ohio. Just the state of Ohio produced more war material than all of the 11 Confederate states combined. They simply didn't have the resources, the manpower, or the support to win the war. They were just simply overwhelmed. I mean, when Lincoln and Secretary of the Navy, Gideon Welles, decided on the Anaconda Plan, they blockaded all the Confederate ports Now, blockade runners came in and out, but that was a trickle. And the battle that were fought up in the north really didn't affect the war outcome. The war's real impact was when Sherman and other generals started moving into the south itself, destroying the railroad, destroying crops and burning buildings to destroy the Sherman was probably the very first modern soldier because he said, you take it to the civilian and you just, and destroy them. The war will come to an end. Lincoln had 2.5 million men in uniform by the end of the war. And General Lee's army, along with General Johnson's army, the two largest armies in the field in 1865, numbered less than 75,000. They were just overwhelmed. They never had a chance to win the war. They were really hoping for a diplomatic solution to make the war so terrible, to win enough battles so that the peace parties of the North would finally say, you know what, let them go. Let them have their own country. That's what they were banking on. But they didn't reckon that Lincoln was saying, I am not going to let those states go. We're going to keep going no matter what. He was called a butcher by a lot of people. And then when Grant took over, Grant was determined to keep going. Even if he lost the battle, he said, all right, forward, let's keep going. And when you have that kind of determination and the number and support, the Confederate troops were starving. They were barefoot. They didn't have anywhere near the resources. What they did have was a belief in their cause, a belief in their country. And they considered the North to be an invader, and they fought back the best they could. The Southern soldiers were among the best light infantry that ever existed. They were fantastic, and they did amazing thing. But you might win the battle, but you're still going to lose the war.
Mark, you said that Grant wanted certain aspects of that to continue. What happened under the Johnson administration before Grant and after Lincoln?
I'm not sure I understand the question, because Johnson didn't become president until Lincoln was assassinated.
Right, and then Grant came after Johnson.
That's a different Grant.
Oh, it's a different Grant. Okay.
I think it's
Ulysses,
a different Grant.
Ulysses S. Grant. You're talking about Ulysses S. Grant?
Yes. Yeah. Hiram Ulysses Grant was his real name.
Yeah, he was president after Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I was just wondering what happened, you know, in between Lincoln and Grant, as far as this issue was concerned.
Well, and there's lots of stuff going on, history, depending on which history you believe, that the South got a lot of what they wanted over time. They couldn't do slavery anymore, but they could find ways of taking advantage of the African Americans amongst them, in other more subtle ways. I don't want to get too deeply down that rabbit hole, but There is a whole, I don't know if you have anything to say about that, Mark, a whole history essentially saying, okay, they didn't quite get what they wanted, but for a while they could continue, you know, using blacks, not quite as slaves perhaps, but keeping them.
Well, they took advantage of their position.
Yeah.
Reconstruction was a horrible mistake. Lincoln had insisted. He told his cabinet on the day he was assassinated. He said, I want the South to be let up easy. When they surrender, we let them go home. We're not going to punish them. I'm not going to go after the leaders of the Confederacy. Let's get back to work. Let's put the country back to work. That was his goal. Johnson did the same, but he wanted some sort of retribution against the South. And Reconstruction was a brutal oppression. It lasted for, it was 80 years before some of the Southern cities even celebrated the 4th of July. It was a bitter resentment. But because the Northerners, the abolitionists, the people that wanted to improve the lives of the African Americans, the slaves, the former slaves, there was a lot of resistance because there were so many Southerners, whether they had ever been slave owners or not, resented the North forcing a federal government on them. And they took every advantage of that. And so they set up what eventually became known as the Jim Crow laws. And to keep separate, but what also became known as separate but equal. it was never equal. It was separate, but it was never equal. And they held on to that for the longest time, for a whole century. But there, I've lost my train of thought here, but it really could have been so much better. If Lincoln had not been assassinated, the country could have been healed much better, much sooner. And I think a lot of Southerners would have said, you know, okay, we have to give up the slave, but, you know, the North is being pretty decent about this. Let's get back to work. You know, people have to go back to their shop. They have to go back to their fields. They have soldiers coming home to start tending their farms again. That's what Lincoln wanted to do.
It's one of the more sort of confusing parts of our history, from my perspective. I don't consider myself an expert in it at all, but, you know, on one side, you know, obviously the South wanted their lifestyle back and didn't want to be, you know, ruled with an iron fist by the North. On the other hand, you know, there was the matter of slaves and how do you, you know, rectify that? And I think to some degree,
slavery was definitely a very hot potato.
Yeah.
And a lot of Northern states didn't want to have anything to do with even touching it. But Lincoln insisted on the Emancipation Proclamation, which went into effect in January of 63. But that only freed the slaves in the states that were then in rebellion. It did not do anything for slaves that were in, say, Maryland or Missouri, any of the states that were pro-Confederate but were not in rebellion. So it was always a minefield to handle. And just freeing them wasn't going to be enough. These people needed to be properly educated, get educated, get housing, be able to take care of their families and raise families and so on. There wasn't enough support in the North to make that happen across the board. So a lot of the former slaves now found themselves as sharecroppers.
Right.
In which their former masters that said, okay, well, we're going to work together. I'll give you feed and everything you need to take that many acres for you, that many acres for you, and we'll share the crop. But it was always, or let me rephrase that. There had to have been some former slave owners that were fair and were willing to work with their former slave. But there were others who took advantage of it and said, oh, they're never going to pay this off. You know, I'm going to make sure that my prices are so high, they'll never make enough to feed themselves. So they're still slaves and they didn't get the same care that they did during the former slaves era. And I'm just incensed about our president trying to change history about and removing anything having to do with slavery at the Smithsonian Institution. It's like he wants to pretend that it never happened or that it didn't matter that much.
I'm curious about something, Mark. When I was in third grade or fourth grade, I first learned about the Civil War and I read my social studies book, A White Guy, and, you know, I never heard of the term African American or Black or Negro at the time. I didn't know what that meant. And we were reading this book and basically I remember coming home from school one day and my mom's essentially saying, what did you learn today at school? And I remember saying something along the lines of, well, you know, we learned about slavery and that was bad. And then there was a war and the North won the war and slavery went away and everything was just fine. And my mom paused and said, I think things are a little more complicated than that.
Yes.
And of course they are. And what I fear is that that's the kind of what I sort of said in my third grade arrogance is exactly what President Trump is trying to do is right. To sort of whitewash the, you know,
that's a good word. Yeah.
Yeah. It is absolutely a good word. And for me, you know, I sort of, after that comment, I didn't know what to make of it, but I got totally turned off by history. Because of that and other things and, you know, sort of stumbled through history and didn't much care until I was much, much older and heard about a story in NPR about Grant and Robert E. Lee and Lincoln and Robert E. Lee and how they got the Civil War resolved. That sort of got me back into history. But, you know, I wonder how many people in my situation had the same kind of experience and then never came back to history. Because of that kind of whitewashing, as it were.
Yeah, it's terrible that so many schools, in order to save budget, you know, they cut back on a lot of the liberal arts and things, but they also cut back on history. teaching in school. I think history is not even required in the required curriculum in California schools after the eighth grade. Now, I imagine, which is unfortunate. But I know it's pretty low.
Which is unfortunate.
Yeah, it is. Because
kids should learn all about this country and all about what led up to
what's going on. If you don't learn the lessons of history, you will repeat the mistakes. And I see that all the time.
And just to keep on, I have a grandkids who are very smart people and are in seventh grade this year. And to the best of my understanding, have not studied any American history at all.
Yeah.
I mean, it
makes me want to cry.
Yeah. It's very incredibly sad. History is a course, a complicated thing. And how do you teach history to folks who are younger? And then, because history is one of those.
I was lucky enough to have some great history teachers who really made it come to life for me.
Yeah.
They knew how to reach out to the student. And even though 30 people in a class, maybe only two or three of them will really feel it. I was one of them, obviously.
Yeah.
I had social studies in my seventh and eighth grade years at Perkins. Then I had U.S. history in my junior year. And then I had history when I was in college. So pretty much 4 years of getting to a lot about history and culture.
Yeah. But 99% of what I know about history, I've learned on my own, not from school. School gave me a simple foundation like that third grade book, just enough to kind of give you the dates and the places and the things that happened. But other than that, I learned history on my own just from being fascinated. And yes, it is far more complicated. I don't know how many books I've read in print and then later on audio about history. And right now I'm reading about the crew of the USS Indianapolis that was sunk by the I-58 on the 30th of July 1945. It had just delivered the atomic bomb to Tinian and was headed to Leyte and was sunk by a Japanese submarine. And it was the worst tragedy, the worst loss of life for the United States Navy. Now, I've known the Indianapolis story for years. I've read three different books on it, but I found another one, a new one, and I said, oh, I'm going to read this because they'll probably have more information that I didn't know. I just keep adding to it and filling in the gaps. That's what I really enjoy about history. I'll read about things that I enjoy, even if I already know about it. I know how the Civil War comes out, the North won. Okay, but I still want to learn.
Yeah. I do want to bring our participants in on this conversation. We have people listening right now who may want to ask you a question, Mark. This is in perspective.
Yeah. We got away from Titanic there, didn't we?
That's okay. You're listening to In Perspective. You're listening to In Perspective, and our featured guest is Mark Carlson, author, military historian, and very knowledgeable about the Titanic. So let me ask Trish if she can let us know if there are any hands raised at this time.
Yes, sir. We do have a hand. Deanna, go ahead.
Hello. Welcome, Deanna. Go ahead.
Thanks, you're muted.
You are still muted.
Deanna, are you with us?
Yeah,
Deanna.
There you are. All right, go ahead.
Hi, Deanna.
I have to keep swiping on this silly iPhone to find the button because it's no longer consistently in one place. What I wanted to ask Mark about is the series that he wrote, which would be sort of science fiction.
Vengeance of the Last Roman Legion?
Mm-hmm. Yes, your Roman Legion series. I just finished it, and I found it very enjoyable and extremely well written to imagine a Roman Legion waking up after 2,000 years and coming out of their tomb and marching off to Germany to punish the Germans for the betrayal that happened in their time frame. It was a very interesting. I thought your characters were well drawn. I thought the premise was a bit bizarre, but it actually worked.
That's the whole point of writing something like that.
Yeah. It worked. You know, I really got involved with the characters, both the ancient ones and the modern ones.
Yeah. Did you have a question?
No, I just wanted to say that I thought you did an excellent job of explaining.
Thank you.
How they lived, how they thought, and
well, that's a good example of that is a good example of how I research things. Before I ever started writing that book, I read every audio book I could find on the Roman army. I have several documentaries. I listened to them and went on the internet and just dug up everything I could so that I would have a factual basis on which to build that story.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted Lucius to be the good guy, even though he was on a mission of revenge and he wanted to kill. I still wanted the reader to feel, you know, hey, here's a great guy and he's lost his family and he wants revenge. Go for it, you know.
And then actually he got it better than he thought he would, because the people that he did attack and he saved.
Don't give away the plot.
Yeah. So that was a double flip that
thank you.
Made it what, in
when
very
my Titanic novel from. When my Titanic novel comes out at the end of the year, I will send it to Bard and have them make an audio of it.
It'll good be called idea.
Phantoms in the Abyss.
A lot title. Of people use Bard.
Yeah.
Bookshare too, Mark.
Bookshare also.
Yeah, and we'll have you back on when the book comes out late. Was it, you said late next year?
This year.
Then we'll bring you back sometime, you know, to talk about the book when it comes out.
Actually, I wrote it about 20 years ago, but I just upgraded it somewhat, and my publisher said, this sounds good. So I did some rewriting and so on. But, I always loved the Titanic story and its people. And when I saw the movie, I still had sight, and I must have seen it 20 times. It was incredible. The only thing that kind of bugged me about the movie was that it made so many people believe that Jack and Rose were real. And whenever I do a lecture about the Titanic, the first slide on my PowerPoint is Jack and Rose are not real. But everything else, it technically did a beautiful job of what it was really like. It'll never be topped as far as I'm concerned.
Thank you, Deanna.
I have to say, I'm probably one of the few people who feel this way, but that song that came from that movie,
My Heart Will Go On.
I thought it was dreadful. And
did you say incredible or dreadful?
Dreadful is what I said.
Really?
I never liked that song. I thought it was way too corny, and I'm happy to never hear that song ever again. She could sing. She had a great voice, but I did not like that song at all.
Oh,
it's worth.
If I ever meet Celine Dion, I will not tell her you said that.
Please don't. Yeah. I love her voice and she sang great songs, but not that one.
Thank you very much, Deanna. Do we have anybody else, Trish?
Yes, sir. We do. Pam, go ahead.
Pam, yes. Welcome.
Hello.
Hello.
Still on the topic of the Titanic. I read an article a number of years ago now. It was a very long and seemingly very well-researched article. I don't remember which periodical it was in, but it was about the consensus of the article was that the Titanic was doomed even before it ever left port, because there were so many corners cut when it was being built. They were on a deadline and there was all this stuff, and that even before the Titanic pulled out of port, there was already a fire in the engine room.
One of the coal bunkers, yes.
When the people who were trying to put it out, you know, trying to make things safe, and they would tell the captain and all the other people involved about it, they kept it very hush-hush. The passengers, the rest of the crew never knew about it, and yet these people were struggling to put fires out, and that had there not been that fire in the engine room, there would not have been a part of the ship that was weakened to the point that it barely had to hit that iceberg before it.
Okay.
Yeah. So I was wondering if you were familiar with.
Oh, I would be glad to.
Thank you. And I will mute.
All right. Addressing the first point about the ship being doomed before it ever left port. First of all, the only corners that were cut was in reducing the number of lifeboats because the Board of Trade, which the regulations went back to 1892, and they did not require ships of that, because ships of that size didn't exist in 1892. So the Board of Trade had not updated their lifeboat regulation. And so Titanic was sailing with a legal number of lifeboats. The corners were cut there. They didn't want to clutter the deck and the extra expense of another 48 lifeboats. That's the first thing. The engine, there were two reciprocating engines, old-fashioned reciprocating engines that were used for the two wing propellers and turbine, Parsons turbine for the center propeller. They cut corners a little bit there. And instead of using turbine, which were already normal for like Mauritania, Lusitania, Aquitania. But as far as the coal fire, that was very common in those days. Some moisture gets into the coal bin, and there were coal bins between all of the boiler room. I think Titanic had 10 different coal bins. And if moisture gets in there, it can heat up and it can start a fire. It's not a real fire. It's just like, it's like burning coals, and you really can't put it out. But that was nowhere near the engine room. The engine room, as you mentioned about the fact that the engine room was weakened. It was weakened for more than one reason, and that was because the steel that was used in those days had a lot of manganese in it, and it made it very brittle in cold weather. So the steel that was on the hull was very brittle. It wouldn't take much stress to crack. And the main engine room was the largest open space on the ship. It went up 3.5 decks and extended for about 110 feet bow to stern. That was the weakest part of the hull. And when the ship was sinking, the ocean surface, the weight of the bow pulling down and the weight of the stern pulling down was being bent at the fulcrum of the ocean surface at the point of that engine room. And that's why the ship split. But it had nothing to do, of course, with the iceberg. The iceberg didn't slash open the hull. It just bumped it and ground it. And the entire iceberg damage had been worked out to 212 feet long by 3/4 inch. And for an opening of what covered about 12 square feet, a very small area. And it opened up the first 5 compartments to the sea. If she had been going 5 knots slower, she would not have suffered as much damage, because she probably would have floated and they could have towed her into port. The other thing that might have been a cost-cutting thing was the fact that the bulkheads that divided the 16 watertight compartments did not extend all the way up to the main deck. They stopped at C deck for passenger convenience. And that allowed water to flow, as you saw in the movie, that allowed water to flow from one flooded compartment over the bulkhead into the next, and that made it inevitable to sink.
Yeah.
But the coal fire really had nothing to do with it. That they were very common in those days. And it was just something of keeping it from getting out of control. That's all they had to do.
But it seems to me what Pam is sort of getting at, is that there seems to be a whole bunch of arrogance that, you know, about the folks who designed it and the folks who sailed it, that we can do anything we want. As you said, the Victorian age, we rule over nature. Britannia rules over the waves.
Yeah, there was a lot of arrogance, no doubt about it. Yeah.
Yeah. And so whenever I've sort of heard about it, I'm not nearly as much of an expert as you are. Mm-hmm. I always have the sense that, you know, this whole thing is a story of arrogance. You know,
yeah, bear in mind, Olympic was a year older than Titanic. Titanic was launched on 31 May 1911 and then went to the graving dock and it was fitted out. Olympic was already in service by that time. Olympic was exactly the same as Titanic. Superficially outside, the forward promenade deck was glassed in on Titanic, but that was it. Otherwise, the ship were exactly the same. They had the same number of lifeboats, the same engines, everything. Olympic sailed for 31 years. Olympic sailed for 31 years without any problem. So the design, there was nothing wrong with the design. It was just that one in a million moment that that iceberg happened to hit the hull at that bad place.
Yes, Trish?
If she had rammed the iceberg head on, if they hadn't seen it in time, if she rammed the iceberg head on, 60 feet of the bow would have been crushed.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody on the ship would have been thrown to the deck. It would have been a horribly violent thing. But you wouldn't have sunk.
Trish, you were going to say something.
I was. Yes. We have 5 minutes and one hand.
All right. Okay, you can bring that person on. Thanks, Pam. Who do we have?
Stacy, go ahead.
All right, Stacy, welcome.
Hey, I was wondering, this has nothing to do with the Titanic. Have you ever read Fears of a Setting Sun? It's about the founders' disillusionment. In fact, it's called Fears of a Setting Sun, Disillusionment.
Well, I recognize that name. Who was the author?
Dennis C. Rasmussen, I believe. Let me get to that exact title out here.
Dennis Rasmussen. Oh, I went to high school with Dennis Rasmussen. I know I haven't read it.
What do you think about it?
Well, I said I haven't read it.
Okay, I'll get you the exact title. Yes.
Fears of a Setting Sun. The Disillusionment of America's Founders by Dennis C. Rasmussen.
Diego. Dennis Rasmussen.
Dennis Rasmussen. Yeah.
I'm going to have to check on that. I went to high school with a Dennis Rasmussen.
Did you? I wonder if it's the same guy. That would be something.
He wrote it's a disillusionment of America's founders, you know. So I think he read it considering today's, you know, situation with the, you know, divided, and the feeling of disillusionment in this country, you know.
That's a good word for it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
Very, very good word.
I think they felt that they were unsure later on, you know, whether this country would actually survive. That's the feeling I get from the book that I've read so far.
I'll have to look that up. I'm going to look that up.
Please do.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated with history. I've tried to read more history in recent days, you know, because I think we were hit with a lot of bull, you know, in school. We really were.
Yeah, that's true.
A lot of baloney. And I've also read works from American Indians and, I mean, American, you know, natives, Native Americans and things like that. I just read one I read a memoir, a Whiskey Tender, a memoir. And that's a book by an American native.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
I think we're almost out of time here, but thank you. Thanks for the recommendation.
Thanks, Stacy, very much. We have about a couple minutes, Mark, so unless we have another hand, you can just wrap up, tell us, you know, any closing remarks.
Tell us sort of where we can get your books and, you know, and all that good stuff, and give us a summary of Titanic again and when it might come out.
Yeah, the book is going to be called Phantoms in the Abyss by Mark Carlson, and it will be released by Sunbury Press later this year and will be available in print and on Kindle. And also I'll make sure it gets on BARD as well. They may also do an Audible version. I haven't found out if that's been done yet. But, yeah, it's a story. I started writing it, and I actually started writing it before the movie came out. And I make that point in my foreword that the movie did not inspire me to write this book. I was working on it before the movie came out. But, yeah, I really enjoyed writing it and using some of the famous people in the story for background and so on.
We are very grateful for having you on the show, Mark, and we learned a lot today about the Titanic and about the military and the Civil War, and I'm sure there are a lot more that you can offer. We'd love to have you back in the future, and thanks for taking the time.
Hey, I was glad to do it. I'm glad to help out in a pinch.
All right. Mark Carlson, ladies and gentlemen, author, military historian, and the author of a book called The Titanic. Well, the title again? What is it?
Phantom in the Abyss.
Phantom in the Abyss. All right. Very good. Thanks, everybody, and go safe with God's abundant blessings. Take care.